It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll hear about a new project that explores Milwaukee's jazz history.
First, four Republican state lawmakers announced yesterday that they'll introduce a bill to restrict abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy.
The GOP lawmakers say the legislation will prevent unborn children from feeling pain. While there's been disagreement over when a fetus can feel pain, the bill defines the 20-week mark as the turning point. Governor Scott Walker has previously said he would sign the bill.
With us now is one of the lawmakers who introduced the bill, Republican State Representative Jesse Kramer of Kewaskum. Representative Kramer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Mr. Ferret.
So let's start with the details. What would change under this new bill?
Okay. Well, there's some basically five big key points with this bill. First of all, some of the requirements for a doctor. One of the requirements right now, one of the reports that has to go to the Department of Health Services every year is the gestational age when an abortion is performed. And this this bill actually requires the doctors to determine post-fertilization age also. And that date, fertilization date, is typically around 2 weeks after the gestational period. So they also have to report that now. In addition, there are a number of notices that a pregnant woman must be given 24 hours before the abortion is performed, and this bill would actually require an additional oral and written notice to the mother of the numerical odds of survival if that child were to be delivered at the stage in pregnancy. So if the mother is 18 weeks along and she decides she wants an abortion, well, the doctor is going to have to say, well, here's the chances of survival if that baby were to be delivered today. And based on a report that came out just Wednesday on the New York Times, actually, that chance of survival, I mean, they're saying at 22 weeks now with medical intervention, they can actually save these babies. So chance of survival, the numerical odds will be in there also. So additionally, there are no abortions that will be allowed after that 20-week post-fertilization period unless it is a medical emergency as already defined by our state statutes. So the definition for medical emergency in the state statutes is being used in this bill, and that's the one that that would still be allowed. However, if it is a medical emergency and they do have to terminate the pregnancy, they have to do it in a way that would give the baby the best chance of survival. So it's not that you're just going in and just automatically aborting the child and terminating the life. Additionally, there's some language in this bill that addresses a diagnosis for a disabled child, which typically people don't get until later in pregnancy, and also that that affects women's health, and that is perinatal hospice. It's something that hasn't been defined in statute before, but there is a requirement now that with this perinatal hospice, the agency would be required to print materials discussing available help that is out there for parents. Basically, if it's determined that the child may, you know, actually have a terminal condition, that from the time on that they decide that this condition is there until the baby is delivered and eventually, you know, may pass away, and even postpartum, that the types of services and things that are available to the parents. So these are some of the key points in this bill relating to pain of unborn children.
So with the 20-week rule in particular, no abortions after 20 weeks except for medical emergency, what's the thinking behind that? What's the goal there?
Basically, I mean, the whole point of this bill is not to ban abortions. The whole point of this bill is that we as a state, it's been determined under Roe v. Wade, we as a state have a compelling interest to protect the life of a child after the point of viability right now. And the point of viability being that the child can survive outside the womb. Well, that doesn't mean that the Supreme Court never said that is the only compelling interest that a state has. What we're looking at here is we have a compelling interest as a state to protect children, unborn children, from horrific, torturous death. And if you can feel pain, it is a horrific experience that this child will be going through. And so that is the point of this bill. It really, right now, 20 weeks is the number that's being used because that's what science has determined when a child can feel pain. However, that's not to say, you know, that's a number that's out there now, but that's not to say, you know, 20 years from now, they're not going to decide, you know, have science out there that says, hey, a kid can feel pain at 16 weeks. So I'm not really calling it a, I'm not calling it a 20-week abortion ban bill. I'm calling it the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, which is what they've been doing throughout the country. They've been talking about it because it's only about, all we're looking at is the pain of these children and the fact that we have an interest to protect them from that torture and from that pain.
There is controversy over that pain at 20 weeks idea. Some national medical groups saying no, that isn't true. The research we're looking at says there isn't detectable pain at 20 weeks.
Well, there are two groups out there that have said that, that we have looked at. Journal of American Medicine is one. There's a report that came out in 2005 by five authors. Two of those authors, I'll point out right now, they're pretty subjective articles. The Philadelphia Inquirer pointed out that one of the lead author was previously employed by NARAL, which is a pro-abortion political organization. And the New York Times also reported in 2005 that another one of the authors actually performed abortions and was an abortion doctor. And it wasn't until 2007, a couple years later, after this article was published, that many of the studies that disprove the article were released. There are countless articles out there from other doctors, British Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Dr. Vivek Glover has talked about it. There's another Dr. Sunny Anand from the Director of Pain and Neurobiology Laboratory, Arkansas Children's Hospital Research Institute. She's discussed this, and they're talking about, I mean, I've got other doctors who like to talk about, but some of these are quoting my opinion, and I quote here, my opinion is based on evidence suggesting that the type of stimulation that will occur during abortion procedures, very likely most fetuses at 20 weeks after conception will be able to perceive that as painful, unpleasant, noxious stimulation. So there are quite a few doctors out here that absolutely oppose these articles, but these are the only two articles that appear to be coming from the other side right now, and there's been a lot of science done since these articles came out that would actually disprove them.
Talking to Representative Jesse Kramer about new legislation on abortion, a statement from Democratic State Senator Nakia Harris-Dodd of Milwaukee, quoting from a bit of it, as legislators, we are not in a position to make informed medical choices for others, and this bill intrudes into the rights of Wisconsin individuals to make private decisions affecting their health care and their families. Your response to that, Representative Kramer?
Well, I don't think the child that's being torn apart in the womb and going through this kind of torture has the ability to speak up. So someone needs to speak for them. Obviously, we as a country do not condone torture. We don't even condone torture of prisoners of war. So I don't think we should condone torture of those children who can't speak for themselves either.
Now, some hesitance, it seems, from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. Seems like he may want exceptions for cases of rape and incest in this law to move it forward. Would you make that compromise to advance the law?
Well, I tell you, as a former emergency services dispatcher, I'm a current firefighter and an EMT, and now as an elected official, husband and father, I have a duty and an emotional attachment to those who are hurting and in pain. I feel absolutely terrible for a woman who would be involved in one of these heinous crimes. However, that does not take away from the fact that we should have a carve-out that would essentially double down on the awful situation and selectively decide which children should or should not be inhumanely tortured to death by tearing them apart limb from limb. So I guess that would be my response to that.
There's talk that if this passes as signed by the governor, it's likely going to be tied up in courts for a long time, as it has been in some other states. Do you anticipate that?
It's possible. There are actually right now 10 states have signed it as of through 2014. A couple of them are tied up in court. The rest are good to go. So we've been kind of fashioning the legislation after some of these other states and looking at what has gone through court and what has been basically stayed by court or enjoined by court order. And actually, the most recent one, a West Virginia bill, just passed in February, so they were the 11th state, and it was a strong bipartisan vote. They actually overrode the Republican governor's veto from last session to get this bill enacted. Two-thirds of the House Democrats voted for it. Most of the Senate Democrats voted for it. So this is not, it is not meant to be a contentious bill. It is about, basically, like I mentioned before, it's about torture and it's about humanity and the fact that we need to be humane and we are a civilized society and we should act as such.
And do you know a timeline before I let you go, Representative Kramer, on
not on hand. I think we're planning on getting it done in fairly short order, probably before the summer. So that's what we're planning right now.
Representative Kramer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Parrott.
That was Republican State Representative Jesse Kramer of Kewaskum.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
You might not know it, but the city of Milwaukee boasts an impressive and rich jazz history, one that's not widely known outside of the city. And when our next guest started looking into that history, he was surprised at how little information he could find about it.
Now he's taking matters into his own hands and digging into the city's musical past to unearth artifacts that bring Milwaukee's jazz history to life, and he's sharing them with the public in a digital archive.
Jamie Brevik is with us now. He's the founder of the Milwaukee Jazz History Project. Jamie, thanks a lot for talking today.
Thank you, Veronica, for having me. It's an honor to be with you guys.
So, Jamie, what got you thinking about putting together Milwaukee's jazz history?
Well, it's actually part of a larger story. Back in 2010, myself and a handful of other local Milwaukee musicians decided to start a jazz advocacy organization called the Milwaukee Jazz Vision. And we've had kind of a multifaceted reach up till this point. Some of our other endeavors have included putting on like a performance series. We've had a number of different concerts we've promoted, trying to build partnerships with other organizations in the city. For example, we are working with the folks over at Summerfest to bring a jazz series back to Summerfest, which has long since been missing. Their flagship stage back in the day was the Miller Jazz Oasis, and that's long gone. But we're working with them to bring that back, as well as many other endeavors, just trying to promote the jazz scene here in Milwaukee. So the History Project came about when I started working with a guitarist in town called Manti Ellis. He's been a very prominent educator and performer in Milwaukee for a long time. He's 82 years old, and he's still very active as a performer. And he started calling me to play with him. And just, I think through getting to know Manti a little bit, he's got an incredible memory. And, you know, he would often share stories with a lot of us on the breaks, on the gigs and whatnot. And I decided to dig a little deeper, as you said, and I did an interview with Manti, which I've posted on our website, and just some fascinating stories to hear firsthand from somebody who has been active since the 1950s. So it kind of sparked an interest to look a little farther and see what I could find. And a lot of the information that was online was either more current, more recent things like on Facebook, and I had a hard time finding things. I should just say online as they sit now.
And you're going to try to make sure that Milwaukee's jazz history doesn't get lost again. You're putting together your own digital archive. What kinds of stuff are you putting in the archive?
Absolutely. Yeah. Right now, I'm sort of just collecting photographs. I've got a page of video clips, things that were already either pre-existing on YouTube, or I was able to find a really nice video of a Dizzy Gillespie interview that was done at UW-Milwaukee in 1972, and I threw that up on there. I've got a whole pile of news clippings and articles that I have yet to go through and scan and organize and put those up on there. But there are a few things that I've put on there, some articles that are up there now. One of the partners that we've worked with a lot is onmilwaukee.com, and the great writer Bobby Tanzillo, and his historian himself. He has helped us out quite a bit, and he sent me all, you know, everything he's ever written on the Milwaukee jazz scene, and that's up there right now. But I've got literally stacks of old images to go through and old news clippings that I've yet to get organized and get up there. I'm hoping to get through that this summer.
Milwaukee had a pretty thriving jazz scene, some big musicians to come out of it, some big jazz players. And we've got a clip here of trumpet player Dick Rudebush, one of the most famous jazz musicians to come out of Milwaukee. Let's take a listen. Oh, that is amazing. Jamie, I know that you're a trumpet player, too. What goes through your mind when you hear that?
Well, It's unfortunate. I believe, if I could be stand corrected, but I believe Dick died very young. And, you know, he is someone I think that's very prototypical of a lot of the musicians that you find in Milwaukee. There's some very, very talented players in town that, for whatever reason, either work or family obligations, have chosen to stay here, but probably could have made it anywhere in the country or the world. You know, Dick Rudebush being one of them, Manti Ellis, whom I mentioned, the great Berkeley Fudge, who is a tenor saxophonist who's still with us in Milwaukee. I think that it's just that unsung nature. You know, people who are about the music and who are about the keeping the tradition alive, but are under the radar. So I think part of the vision of this archive is to maybe just bring some recognition to some of those musicians.
We're talking to musician and history buff Jamie Brevik about Milwaukee's jazz history. He's putting together a digital archive about that history. And Dizzy Gillespie was in Milwaukee. He was at WTMJ in the early 70s talking about his thoughts on whether or not Milwaukee had a future in jazz. Let's listen.
I see jazz on a level, on the highest level in music, because it is rich and is vibrant and rural. So therefore, I see it way, way up. I have my eyes set on where jazz is supposed to be, and it's way above what it is now.
It's kind of cool to hear Dizzy Gillespie in Milwaukee on a Milwaukee TV or radio station. Did Milwaukee become a hub that could attract big stars like Dizzy?
Well, I think Milwaukee was a lot like a lot of cities at that time. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, when jazz was more prominent, popularity-wise, I guess. But I think back then, what you saw, and this was definitely shared with me in my interview with Manti and my acquaintances who have experienced music outside of Milwaukee, that I think back then it was much easier for musicians to tour, and so you had a circuit, if you will, of clubs and venues that musicians could tour, and they could tour through the country. They would come through Milwaukee. They would come, you know, maybe between Chicago and Minneapolis. We had the great Jazz Gallery, which is a wonderful venue in Milwaukee that hosted every big name in jazz you could imagine between 1978 and 1984. So I think back then you had that opportunity where big name artists, for example, Dizzy Gillespie, they would come through towns like Milwaukee much more frequently and get a chance to make an impression on the musicians there, maybe even work with some of the musicians and certainly some of the students, as in the video with Dizzy you mentioned. That was actually, he was in Milwaukee, I found out, in 1972. He was in town to do a clinic and performance at UW-Milwaukee, and that's when they did that interview with him. So, yeah, I think that has kind of gone away a little bit, where big name artists are touring through towns like Milwaukee.
Did being so close to Chicago help or hurt Milwaukee? Because on the one hand, you could think, well, these big names will go to Chicago for sure, and then they'll swing by Milwaukee. But also, you could just see Chicago kind of dwarfing Milwaukee.
Right. Actually, I don't see it as a negative thing at all. In fact, I think even recently, I think there's more and more connection between the two cities. And I think, for example, the Jazz Estate, which is our wonderful jazz club in Milwaukee, Matt Turner, who is a current owner, is really drawing on some of those bigger name artists and bringing them back in through town. I also see a lot of collaboration between Milwaukee and Chicago artists. Me, myself, as a performer, I know plenty of players down there. It's a very rich and vibrant scene still. And I see a lot more collaboration, actually, and musicians from Chicago coming up and performing in Milwaukee and vice versa. There's some great players in Milwaukee that are getting some opportunities to work down there. So I think it is not necessarily Chicago dwarfing Milwaukee per se. I just think I think our proximity has done nothing but give us more of a connection to a larger scene.
And how would you describe, you know, the current jazz scene in Milwaukee? You're at the forefront of efforts to revive it, to bring it back to Summerfest, and make sure it's thriving. But where is it right now?
I see it as being very strong. To be honest with you, the one thing I can say is that there and has always been the case. There are some fantastic performers and teachers here in Milwaukee. We have the wonderful Wisconsin Conservatory of Music, which has a long and storied tradition itself. Mark Davis, Eric Jacobson, the whole staff over there, everybody's fantastic, and they're bringing up the next generation as well as being active performers themselves. We have a great program at UW-Milwaukee with Kurt Hanrahan. The Milwaukee Youth Symphony Orchestra has a wonderful jazz studies program led by Chris Mell. Fantastic teachers, Neil Davis who and Isaiah Joshua, who are running the West End Conservatory. I mean, there's a lot. I think more now than ever, there are education opportunities. And I think that speaks a lot in that we have a constant stream of wonderful young players coming up.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you so much for having me, Veronica. I appreciate the time.
History buff Jamie Brevik. He's putting together a digital archive of items relating to Milwaukee's jazz history. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
All I want to do is drink beer for breakfast.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Food Friday time, and we're going to talk about something near and dear to many Wisconsinites. Beer. And we'll be getting some ideas about how to enhance your food experience by choosing a beer that pairs well with the meal you're eating.
And we want to hear from you, too. What beers and foods go well together? Do you have a favorite beer and food pairing? Do you pay close attention to choosing that specific beer to enjoy with a meal, or you just get a good meal and a good beer and hope it all works out? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Kyle Nabilsi is a beer and food writer for Isthmus, and he joins us now to break down the many different ways that we can pair beer with food. Kyle, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get started, can you walk us through some of the different beer styles, sort of a beer 101?
Sure. The earliest fork in the family tree, I guess, of beer is ale versus lager. It doesn't mean a whole lot in terms of like the average drinking experience because the differentiation is more on the production side than it is on like the flavor side. But there are some, you know, some truisms for each style that will tell you kind of what you're getting into as a drinker, as opposed to if you were, say, a brewer. But, you know, those styles are basically determined by how hot the beer is when it's prepared, when it's fermenting, the kinds of critters that go into the fermentation process. But, you know, there are so many different kinds of ales and lagers that differ from each other that it's almost like saying, hey, the animal kingdom, it's birds and spiders, you know. So, you know, you've got things like stouts, you've got things like pale ales, and they can vary distinctly within that one style of ale. And then you have on the lager side, you've got you know, Bock or Pilsner, things like that, where they can be very different, they can look very different, and if someone who doesn't really know a whole lot about beer were to look at them, they'd say these aren't the same beverage.
Now, I know in the wine world, it's like an art form combining the right wine with the right food. If I'm in that situation, I usually just ask somebody who knows something.
Right.
Is there a comparable thing with beer?
There is, you know, one of those things about wine that it sort of the people who advocate for wine and food pairings get a bad rap for is that it can be taken very seriously. And that's partially due to the fact that, you know, wine and food has been a thing sort of in the public consciousness for so much longer than beer and food. So you sort of have more of a reputation than you do a reality with that. I like to say, and you know, maybe this isn't the best for the interview, but there's really no don't in the do or don't list. And I think that's kind of true with wine too, but you may have fewer people who will say it. But ultimately with beer and food, you go with what works. You know, there are degrees of like certification the same way there is for wine. You know, you have sommeliers in the wine world, and there is a similar certification process for beer.
Really?
Yeah. It's called Cicerone, and it's that's both the noun and the name of the program. You would be a Cicerone if you went through the program. But, you know, it's getting to know the styles, how they interact with food, as well as how they're produced and things like that. So you could pursue that certification if you wanted to, you know, have your business card, have the word on it. But I think even though people are coming around to the idea of beer and food pairing, it's still a little more casual.
do you think that there are just a few basic types that we can start out with if we want something that's not going to interfere too much with the flavor of whatever it is we're eating, something that's just going to complement it? What are one or two things you can't really go too wrong with? Sounds like everything, but beyond that.
Right. That is the thing, the rule that you can sort of apply to this is it's not necessarily a right or wrong thing, but how much do you want that interaction to be prominent? You know, do you want to basically just have your food and have a beverage that more or less just washes it down? Or do you want to have more of a equal footing kind of interaction? So if you're just looking for something that's kind of inobtrusive, you know, something like a Kolsch is really going to do you well.
What is a Kolsch?
A Kolsch is going to be in a lot of ways similar to the sort of American lager style of beer that, you know, the average non-self-described beer drinker would drink, you know, the Miller Lite, the Bud Light, that kind of thing. It's going to be clear. It's going to be golden. It's going to be crisp. And its flavor is not really going to step on a lot of other things. It's going to taste good on its own, but it's in terms of interacting with food, it's more or less going to take a backseat to the food itself.
And I know you said there are no don'ts, but are there cases where there's going to be a beer with a more distinctive flavor that might interfere with, you know, our entree or something?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can't expect every beer to play nice with every food. So you can't have like this 12% Russian Imperial Stout with, you know, thick and black as motor oil.
So that's like that's a meal itself.
Yeah, and then pair it with sushi, you know, because it's just going to run rampant all over it. Although, and this is one of the things that really gets focused on with beer pairing, there is the idea of contrast in beer pairing, and it really does give a lot of license really to just about anything. You know, if it tastes good, go with it. But if you're looking for a justification in terms of, you know, the world of beer and food pairing, you say, well, you know, this is a contrasting flavor. This is a contrasting element to whatever it is that I'm eating. The beer is going to be something totally different, you know, or if you're having, beef bourguignon or something really rich and savory on the food side, and then you had that Kolsch, you know, you're not going to notice the Kolsch very much. It'll be fine. But it's not going to bring its own thing to the meal the same way that a fuller-bodied or a more acidic beer would.
Now, I'm someone who doesn't know a whole lot about beer. Are there types of beers or specific beers that you should avoid? You know, if you look at the wine world, there are certain wines that go in and out of fashion. People used to make fun of people who drank Chardonnay a lot. Is there a beer equivalent to that?
I don't think so. You know, the one thing that beer and craft beer will sort of take heat for is being a little too cool for school sometimes. So, you know, if you're treating it goofy and kind of being a little bit ironic about it, that's probably going to fit in okay with a lot of the, you know, people that are in the scene too, but it probably isn't giving the meal its sort of due dignity, I guess, you know, as a pairing. If you're trying to argue that beer is equivalent to wine in terms of food pairing, then sort of just throwing it together haphazardly. If you're not just saying, I don't really care, I want to have a good beer with good food, or on the other side, I want to pair something very consciously, just whipping it together doesn't really do anything any service.
Talking to Kyle Nabilsi about pairing food and beer. It's Craft Beer Week in Madison, American Craft Beer Week next week coming up, a good timely topic. Let's get into some specific foods. Let's get a good burger. What beers pop to mind if we're just having an old-fashioned beef burger?
You know, I like to think of burgers like it's a set of primary colors. You know, it's obviously a prepared food. It's got its own complexities, but so much of the food ingredients in a burger are kind of untouched. You know, obviously a bun is baked and a burger is cooked, but the vegetables that go on there in a very classic cheeseburger are going to be, you know, a fresh lettuce, a fresh onion, a fresh tomato, fresh pickles, those kinds of things, you know, where the flavors are really clean and just stand out on their own. I don't necessarily want to bring a whole lot to that. You know, so again, that's another place where a Kolsch or a fairly low hoppy kind of pale ale would be good, where it's crisp and it's got a little bit of bite to it to sort of cleanse your palate, because, you know, burgers have fat in them. And that's another characteristic that people always look to with beer and food pairings, is that ability to cut through a flavor. So if you've got something that's a really rich, really kind of like juicy, sort of greasy, or even, you know, like a bar burger, that kind of thing, where there's a lot of cheese and it's gooey, you want something that'll sort of cut through that, because all those fats are going to stick to your tongue. And while that's great with a burger on its own, it does kind of impede your ability to taste the other things in your meal. You know, that's where the salt and the French fries comes in, for example, you know, because it kind of wipes the palate clean a little bit. The beer can do the same thing. So I like something with a little bit of a bite to it, more or less clean, crisp, and you know, not one that you're going to want to drink at room temperature, and one that you can drink cold and still appreciate for what it is.
You mentioned cheese. So what do you recommend for either like a cheese tasting menu, or maybe you want to sit down to a basket of fried cheese curds? Is there a do or a don't there for that? What goes well?
Well, we'll take an order. If you're doing a cheese plate, I mean, everyone likes to do kind of a variety with a cheese plate. So, I mean, if you've got a couple of beers in your fridge and you're inviting people over to do this, you know, have a little dinner party or, you know, something like that, that's a perfect opportunity to open up a bottle and pour it in small portions for everybody and have the same kind of tasting menu with the beer that you do with the cheese. So if you've got something kind of nutty, like a Gouda or something like that, you could do an alt beer that's going to have the same sort of nutty characteristics that'll play nicely with that, or a nut brown, you know, ale on the other side. If you're doing something really gooey, you know, like a brie, you might want to go with something a little more potent because that cheese is going to be sort of funky and rich, and you'll want something a little bit more either acidic or carbonated, you know, really well carbonated to sort of break through that on your palate. And, you know, if you did something like a Pleasant Ridge Reserve, you know, something that's a harder cheese, or a cheddar, you know, a cheddar you can play a lot with because those flavors are so big. You know, milk stout is really nice with a cheddar, sort of play off of that sort of creamy mouthfeel and the obviously the dairy angle, but then the milk stout's got the roasted malts.
Is that what makes it a milk stout, roasted malt?
Lactose is actually
the
sugar inclusion in there. Yeah, it's an unfermentable sugar, so it creates a certain mouthfeel and a little bit of sweetness as well that mimics the kind of sensation you'd get with milk.
Now, say we're having like a spicy dish. I read somewhere that sweet calms heat. Sweet beers with our spicy, I don't know, Mexican food, Indian food, Thai food?
Yeah. You know, I do tend to stick to the school that the only thing that's going to save you if you're eating spicy food is milk.
Uh-huh. But not a milk stout.
Not a milk stout, right. I mean, you could give it a shot. Why not? If it works, it works. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of conventional wisdom that, you know, you drink IPAs with spicy food because, you know, the India pale ale, it's you know, it hails back to India, and typically a lot of people have this conception of Indian food and curries as being very spicy. They may not always be, but it's that kind of thought process as well. You know, you've got something really spicy, you need something to kind of distract your palate a little bit and sort of break through that, so that bitter can sort of calm it down a little bit. Sweet beers are typically a thicker mouthfeel as well, you know, with those sugars that are in there. So that's certainly something that can sort of give a soothing sensation definitely to your palate, whether it's like a barley wine or a Doppelbock, something like that. That's really going to sort of lay its own hammer down on your tongue and, you know, to sort of fight back the spice. Yeah.
We're talking to beer and food writer Kyle Nabilsi about choosing the perfect beer to enjoy with your meal. Craft Beer Week here in Madison. Next week is American Craft Beer Week. Thought it was a perfect time to take up the topic.
And we're taking your calls, too. What are your favorite beer and food combinations? Have you come across any secret hits that work well together? Call in, share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our Food Friday discussion right now about beer and food pairings with Isthmus beer and food writer Kyle Nabilsi. Madison is nearing the end of Craft Beer Week, and American Craft Beer Week is right around the corner, so we're getting some recommendations.
And you can join in with yours. What beers and foods go well together? Is there something you always serve when you grill out? Something you always get when you get the fish fry? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Larry on the line in Dubuque, Iowa. Larry, hi.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to say I was able to student teach over in Germany as part of my education, and they were famous for smoked beer over there. But my main point is that whenever I had Wiener Schnitzel or any other kind of thinner meat that was breaded, I had a half liter of a Hefeweizen with it, which is perfectly crisp. And it tied in together really well with anything that I had for a meal over there.
Larry, thank you so much for sharing that experience. So Hefeweizen, that's a half wheat beer. Is that what that means?
Yeah, it's going to be pretty yeasty. It'll be cloudy. This is the style of beer that you typically see with an orange or a lemon stuck into the glass. You know, within the beer, it's providing a little bit of contrast to the not heavier nature necessarily of the beer, but the thicker or the cloudier nature. You have that little bit of sort of acidic punch to it.
So I think you mentioned smoked beer. Did I hear that
right? What's that?
What
yeah.
is smoked beer?
Rauchbier is the German. Yeah, that's the style name. And typically what that means, I mean, 99 out of 100 times what that means is that the malt has been smoked. So whether the barley or, you know, whatever grain is going into the beer, it's spent some time in a smoker. It's taken on smoky flavors, smoky elements.
Really?
Actual...
So like a smoked cheese or a smoked meat,
yeah.
it's going to taste like exactly
that? Exactly the same way. Yeah, Rauchbiers are... famous/infamous for tasting a little bit hammy, a little bit like bacon. And you can really dial that up to a degree that gets pretty tough to get behind sometimes. And like, I like my bacon, I like my ham, I don't necessarily want it with my beer in the glass at the same time.
Okay, so what about a cheese soup? If you're cooking with a recipe that might have bacon, like a cheese soup, is this a good beer to put in there?
Rauchbier, yeah, absolutely. I have a can of a stout that has cumin in it, which isn't smoked, but it's got a very strong cumin-y flavor, and it has that sort of slightly smoky, slightly spicy flavor to it. And I've got plans for making chili with that. You know, it's really thick, it's deep, roasty beer flavors, but then in addition to that, it's got some of these adjunct flavors, these added ingredients beyond the traditional four that really brings a lot of flavor to the beer. One thing I wouldn't recommend, and this is from personal experience at home, is if you're going to make a soup, really of any kind that includes beer, stay away from hops. And this is kind of true with cooking with beer in general, although, again, there's no hard and fast don't, but be very careful if you're cooking or making a soup or whatever with a hoppy or an otherwise bitter beer. Those flavors that taste really great in the glass or the bottle or the can are going to break down, and those volatile oils and flavor components are going to start to do different things. And if you don't want to have a really sort of pungent, bitter French onion soup, for example, which is what we find out at my house, that using an amber ale with a lot of hops in it is just not the way to go for a French onion soup, because it's just going to taste really harsh. So you got to look out for that when you're cooking with beer.
Our caller was talking about a German beer with a German food. Are you always pretty safe going with beer from the country of origin of your food?
Well, you know, I think that's one of the things that sort of has given craft beer its prominence lately is that sort of parallel drive to locality, you know, eating and drinking things that are near to you, to where you are. So, you know, pairing a beer from Japan with sushi, that certainly works. You know, obviously the people in Japan are doing just fine with that menu. But you don't have to. You know, that's the thing about craft beer, is that it really, you can run globally.
It's the international language.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, whatever works in your pairing, go nuts.
Now, you gave us some suggestions for entrees and beers in restaurants around Wisconsin. Start us off in Milwaukee. Where should we go and what should we pair?
Well, just the last few days ago was the James Beard Awards gala, which for the first time in its 25-year history was held in Chicago, so into the Midwest. It's normally been in New York every year prior. And Justin Carlisle at Milwaukee's Ardent Restaurant was a nominee for Best Chef Midwest. He didn't win, but there's always next year. But one thing that he does pretty interestingly with his restaurant is he closes down at sort of a normal closing time in the evening on, I believe it's Fridays and Saturdays, but instead of going home for the night, turns it into a ramen shop. So he pulls the shades, puts a red light bulb in, and calls the place Red Light Ramen. So he's got big, rich, steaming hot, you know, savory bowls of tonkatsu ramen. So it's got pork bone. It's going to have a really strong flavor, very rich. It's going to coat your tongue in a lot of different ways. And he serves exactly one beer, and it's PBR. this is where I was saying you can kind of roll with a little bit of the ironic beer menu. He does also serve cocktail slushies. He's got an old-fashioned slushy, and then I think he does a rotating second cocktail slushy. So it's, you know, the brandy slush that everybody in Wisconsin above the legal drinking age knows about. So he does that. And, you know, it actually does work. The idea, you know, with a PBR and a big bowl of ramen, it makes sense. It's going to be served cold. It's crisp. It's kind of inobtrusive. So, you know, you're taking big slurps of your noodles, and every now and then you sort of cut through all that flavor and heat, temperature heat, not spice heat, with a cold, crisp, refreshing drink of beer, or, you know, the cocktail slushy if it works. I would say, you know, let's say you got a bowl to take home and you had a glass of beer with that at home. I would say my dream pairing would be New Glarus's Berliner Weiss beer. Just came out in this year's iteration. They've found that it's a pretty solid hit in their seasonal lineup. And it's another German style beer, similar in a lot of ways to the Hefeweizen that the caller was talking about. But it's going to be tangier. It's on that sort of path towards a sour beer. It's going to be brisk, though. It's not going to be like vinegar necessarily, really heavy, oppressively sour.
Hey, can you briefly take us to Appleton? You had a combo there, too.
Oh, yeah, sure. Again, another German tie-in. There's a brew pub up there, Stone Cellar. Appleton's my hometown area, so I do a good bit of dining and drinking when I'm visiting up there with family. And the chef there, Brady Ahrens, does a Jaeger Schnitzel. So pounded, you know, pork, breaded, fried. From the beer list there, the Scottish ale seemed like a pretty good pairing with that. You know, something that's hearty, got a little bit of a roasty element to it, you know, some caramelized flavors that are going to go well with a dish that's heavy like that, and, you know, the vegetables that would accompany it. Throwing another dream pairing in there, you know, if you could do an all-star team kind of pairing meal, I might go close to the Scottish ale and do Carbon Four's Lady Luck Irish Red. I really like that beer. Where it differs from, say, the Scottish ale or the average Scottish ale is it's got a little bit more of a hop presence. So it's going to cut through some of those fatty, richer flavors, and that bitterness is just going to dial down some of the sweetness from the, you know, the sauce and the caramelized breading, you know, the fried breading, provide a little bit more contrast.
All right, Kyle, a lot of great ideas. Thanks so much for being with us today.
You bet.
That was Kyle Nabilsi, food and beer writer for Isthmus. He joined us to talk about beer and food pairings on the eve, more or less, of American Craft Beer Week. After weeks of rumors, it's official. The Muppet Show is going to make a comeback to primetime TV.
Sounds like Kermit, Miss Piggy, Gonzo, all your favorites are going to be back. The ABC network grabbed the show. Netflix apparently also interested. They didn't get it. But there's a twist where the original show centered around that live variety show format put on each week by the Muppets. The new series is going to be kind of like the Muppets meets The Office, a workplace documentary feel.
Yeah, and I guess it's going to be targeted more toward grown-ups than the original Muppet Show used to be. So I wonder if this is, the target audience is the people who grew up with the Muppets more than, you know, kids who might watch them today.
Although it's true that the original Muppet Show is more grown up than you think when you look back at
it. Yeah, it was like way over my head. A lot of the stuff as a kid. Definitely. Have you tried your kids on Muppets?
Yeah, I have. And like I was saying, some of it, I kind of went, whoa, that's a little advanced for them.
Well, the disappointing thing for me, they just had no interest. It was not a winner. So I know it's a generational thing, maybe.
That kills me. I love the Muppets.
I know. So
but
do I.
The cool thing about this, we might get to find out what exactly Gonzo is.
Yeah, he's a... I don't know. Well, we'll go to the news with the theme from the original Muppet Show. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Always come here. I guess we'll never know. It's like a kind of torture to have to watch the show.
But now let's get me started. Why don't you get me started?
It's time to get things started on the most sensational, inspirational, celebrational